thank you very much, and also thank you very much for inviting me to come here and also for giving me the opportunity to talk a little bit about my work. And the storyline that I want to tell you today is that I'm working on asymptotically safe quantum gravity, and I'm going to introduce you to the particular approximation scheme that I'm working in there, which is the approximation scheme in expanding in correlation functions of fluctuating gravitons. And the catch will be that we have been recently extending this formalism to also include path integrals or backgrounds with Lorentzian signature to it. And I will come to how we are doing this and what we have learned from this. But I want to start with, of course, putting us all on the same page in the sense of what is it actually that we are after here. So I want to keep the following assumptions, namely that the metric carries the fundamental degrees of freedom, and also want to remain within the setup that diffeomorphism invariance is the fundamental symmetry of our theory. If I start with these assumptions, then the object that I'm interested in is the path integral over metric fluctuations with an action that respects this diffeomorphism symmetry. And I've written down here two versions because most of the time that people work in this area, they work in the Euclidean signature. So here I have the Euclidean version of the path integral. But since I'm also want to move towards a Lorentzian signature, I've also written down the Lorentzian version of the path integral. But in this, in some sense, this abstract object, this is the one that I'm interested in. Of course, the way that I wrote it down, it doesn't make any sense. Not well defined. So in order to make more sense out of this, we need to actually say what we want to do with this. And this, for example, includes that we won't need to introduce sources. We don't want to describe an empty universe. We will need to introduce a gauge fixing and ghost terms, and as well as regularization in order to remove the divergences from this integral. If I'm doing this, then I'm getting to this new now modified object, where now instead of integrating over g mu nu, I'm saying that g mu nu is some background, g bar mu nu, and a fluctuation over it. And I'm integrating over the fluctuation over some background. And now this is the generating functional of correlation functions, which depends on the chosen background and on the sources on the source term that I've written down here. And what I've also already indicated here is that now I have things which depend on a sum of background plus fluctuation. This is my gauge invariant, diffeomorphism invariant action that I'm starting with. So for example, the Einstein-Hilbert actions or variants thereof. And then I have also terms which do not respect this diffeomorphism symmetry because they are gauge fixing operators. Those are then BRST invariant, but they are not diffeomorphism invariant. So they depend separately on the background and on the fluctuation. This does, of course, not mean that the theory that I'm describing is not diffeomorphism symmetry. Diffeomorphism invariant, I just need to fix the gauge in order to compute the observables that I'm interested in.
But set is independent of g bar in the set.
It is dependent on g bar in the end.
It is, yes.
But in the end, if you evaluate at vanishing sources, then not anymore. So this is the catch in some sense. So this object depends on the background. If I evaluate it at vanishing sources, it doesn't anymore. If I now take derivatives.
So when j is equal to 0, it's independent of g bar.
Yes.
Okay.
And if I then take derivatives with respect to the sources, and then I set j to 0, this is how I generate my correlation functions. But I need to set j to 0. I need to introduce the source term in order to first of all generate these correlation functions. This is what I'm saying. So this is abstractly, in some sense, the object that I'm interested in. And of course, now the question is, what methodology do you want to use to tackle this question? And there's, of course, many different ones. You can use perturbation theory, you can the lattice. And the most of the time, I will be talking today about functional methods in order to solve this path integral.
So h is not is required to be small or not?
No, in this context, h is not required to be small.
But it takes values in all r, I guess.
Sorry?
Yeah, so it's not a metric. So g mu nu and g mu nu bar are metrics remaining on Lorentzian, and h mu nu is just real components.
Yeah, so
restrictions.
So h hat is the variable that we integrate over. So this is obviously not restricted by any size, but of course, large fluctuations might be suppressed by the metric. Let me note also, since this h is the expectation, so h without a hat is the expectation value of h hat. So, and now I think the more reasonable question to ask is h mu nu without a hat, is that a small quantity? And that obviously also this depends on the background that is chosen. If I choose a ill-suited background for my computation, then I would have a large h mu nu. And if I would have choose an on-shell background in some sense, then I have a small, on average, small fluctuations around it. Does that answer?
But you integrate overall.
Yeah. But I mean, the question is, of course, if how is it? Is it a suppressed fluctuation or not?
No. But since the result cannot depend on t bar.
Yes, it's strange.
Then, right, okay,
The set of correlation functions does not depend on g bar at j equals 0, but of course here it still does depend on g bar. So obviously you want to choose a good g bar to make your computations feasible and easy. I didn't do anything. This is in some sense standard quantum field theory, I would say.
The reason why it doesn't depend on g bar when j is 0 is because you normalize it to 1 in that case. So what is the, why is that?
So why this does not depend on, it's not obvious from this expression, but after integrating over the h mu nu, like these terms that depend separately on g bar and h, they drop out if j is 0. What was another question? Okay. All right, then I'm very happy, by the way, that there's already so many questions. So if this keeps on going, I'm very happy.
Just you.
All right, so maybe I think I don't need to say much about this slide. I just wanted to quickly say one word about perturbative approaches to this path integral, just to emphasize again, what is the failure? So what is the thing that we need to tackle if we go beyond perturbation theory? So what are the most important things? So for example, in this path integral, I could use the Einstein-Hilbert action as the action to integrate over. And in this case, I find very quickly that the theory is non-predictive, which is be seen already from the negative mass dimension of the Newton coupling. So you have at each loop order, you generate new divergencies that you cannot reabsorb in your action. Of course, I could conversely start with a higher derivative action where I now have dimensionless couplings, and this is now a renormalizable theory. But the problem is that it is a non-unitary theory. So this would be the tree-level propagator in this theory. And now I can do a partial fraction decomposition. I have the standard massless graviton. And then I have a ghost state with which has the mass of the Planck scale. And of course, I suppressed here also the coupling. So there are some other couplings floating around. And depending on the sign of the coupling, it could even be a tachyon. So this is the problem in perturbation theory. So now if we, what I'm advocating, what the asymptotic safety approach does is it abandons perturbation theory and uses non-perturbative methods. But these are the things that, of course, need to be in and addressed in a non-perturbative approach. So the functional method then to analyze this this path integral is the functional randomization group. I don't want to introduce the method in detail, but I just want to, in some sense, give you an idea of what the method is doing. So we are interested in computing the path integral. That's the object that I started with. And instead of computing a path integral, I'm turning now the path integral into a differential, in a functional differential equation. So I'm introducing a cutoff. The cutoff is introduced via a regulator function. And then I can, so this basically cuts off modes at a certain scale. And then I can take a derivative with respect to this cutoff. And this turns my integral into a differential equation. So this means that for k, and now k is the scale in which I cut off modes. And for k to infinity, I then go basically to the bare action, or in case of asymptotic safety, to the fixed point action. And when I lower k, I subsequently integrate out modes, shell by shell, in momentum space, you can imagine this. And eventually, I have, at the endpoint, I have solved the path integral, and I have obtained a quantum effective action. So I turn my, and there's also a Legendre transform involved. So before I talked about the generating functional, now I'm talking about the quantum effective action, which is a Legendre transform of that. But the main part is we turn a path integral into a differential equation. And this, so the idea is to integrate out modes momentum shell by momentum shell, and in the end, obtain the quantum effective action. Yeah?
I have a question. So as far as I understand, the path integral for Einstein gravity is comparably well studied. On the other hand, if you consider quadratic gravity, as far as I know, people are not quite sure how to gauge fixed relay or the problem of group of copies. So all these problems seem to go away if you look at this equation. So how does this fit together that you can address so much higher truncations with such an equation compared to if you actually wanted to evaluate the problem?
I mean, the Grebov problem is of course, it is present, I think, in Einstein-Hilbert truncations and in higher derivative truncations in principle. And of course, one would need to, if I would like to address a Grebov problem, I would need to study a generalized action compared, other than Einstein-Hilbert, like a Grebov 20er analog of gravity. But maybe I'm not sure if I understood fully your question.
The path integral comes with many open questions.
Absolutely. So there's many open questions, including that of Grebov copies.
But the question is, how can you turn it into a differential equation where all these questions seem to be hidden?
Well, I mean, in many approaches to path integrals, these questions remain hidden, I would think. I mean, the Grebov problem is suppressed, for example, at weak coupling. And of course, in gravity, we want to somehow study strong gravitational coupling. But in the end, it's not clear that do we not see it because it's at higher coupling, or do we not see it because the methodology is not yet there to see it in the truncations? I mean, I don't think, I mean, so to put a different answer to the question. So this is not, of course, a tool that simplifies solving path integrals tremendously, but the strength of this tool is that one can implement in a functional method in systematic approximation schemes to it. So I can start with an approximation, I can systematically improve it. And that's why I can turn a path integral into Does this somehow answer the question, or do you want to?
General, for a non-randomized theory, different from this one, you can do the same, right?
But I can tackle any non-randomizable theory, yes.
And then here, the hope is that you will get something that is randomizable at the end, or what is the?
Yes, the idea is that to get something which is non-perturbatively renormalizable. So for this, you actually need the existence. Actually, I can go to my next slide. So for this, you need the existence of an interacting UV fixed point. So in some sense, that the divergences that you encounter in perturbation theory resum due to the existence of a fixed point such that predictivity is restored. So that if you would throw it into an, you can't throw it on any non-perturbative, non-renormalizable theory, and it would always give you a correct result. So the answer cannot, if there would be no fixed point, the theory is also non-perturbatively non-renormalizable. So it's not like that this methodology makes everything renormalizable. That is not the case. Instead, yeah, as I said, we want to study gravity. And
there are examples of simpler non-renormalizable theories where that happens. Where?
Actually, yeah, example of a perturbatively non-renormalizable, but non-perturbatively renormalizable.
Yes, you can, for example, look at cross-Neveu models in other dimensions. And I think the, how is it?
Easing model in 3D or something.
Yeah, easing model in 3D is yeah. So there's fermionic systems, there's scalar systems, where in three dimensions, for example, where this happens. And yeah, you also have confirmations from other methods, such as lattice. And
I disagree with these statements. For instance, the Eason model. It is true that there is a non-trivial fixed point, but it's an infrared fixed point.
Right.
It's not also about that fixed point.
For the Eason model, yes, but yeah.
You've got to take the non-linear sigma models, but again, it's kind of infrared fixed points. So I don't think that maybe there are these claims that people have. In three-dimensional cross-Neveu model, that they can make it non-perturbative. But usually they come with some special methods which violate some of the very general axioms, the Weidman axioms and so on. So I think it's a more solid discussion, but maybe let's not...
I would be curious to talk about this, I did not know about the violation of Weidman axioms in the cross-Neveu case.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, this also doesn't come from anywhere, right? I mean, we know that there is a UV fixed point in 2 plus epsilon dimensions. So there you have perturbative control because of the epsilon expansion above two dimensions.
I have to object again because there is no quantum field theory in 2 plus epsilon dimensions. This is again a mathematical extrapolation of something which clearly will not satisfy the Weidman axioms because they are not formulated in 2 plus epsilon dimensions. So if you calculate the energy momentum tensor, for example,
Of course, I mean, 2 plus epsilon is not a physical theory, but it at least it has a mathematical UV fixed point in 2 plus epsilon dimensions.
Well, you can continue this, you can make the large N expansion of certain series, and they can also be summed. But then again, the large N expansion is not a quantum field theory as such, you know, but some truncation of some limits which violate some axioms.
But now if I think about the Wilson-Fischer fixed point there, I also see,
this is an infrared fixed point.
But I also do an epsilon expansion, and there the expansion works.
Yeah, but this is an expansion with in 4 minus epsilon dimensions.
But why can I not use an expansion in 2 plus epsilon if it works in 4 minus epsilon for the Wilson?
You're using in any dimension to claim that this is a non-perturbative quantum field theory. As such, you know, you have to go to three dimensions, and there
Exactly. So I mean,
but there, I mean, you do not have control over this fixed point because epsilon is not small, but it's one.
Yes, absolutely. I agree to that. I mean, we want to. I'm just saying, in 2 plus epsilon, there's one, and the question is, how far does it extend? And it could be. And of course, we in asymptotic safety, we study directly D equals 4, and we hope to gain insights in this.
I'm perfectly sympathetic to that.
Yeah. So, if now in D equals 4, this to describe what is happening in this D equal 4 scenario. We have here, for example, the lowest order truncation, which was studied by Martin Reuter, 96. And here you have the dimensionless cosmological constant and a dimensionless Newton coupling. And indeed, there you find an attractive UV fixed point. In this truncation, you have two couplings, two UV relevant directions.
So truncation and what?
So you need to make a systematic approximation scheme. And I will come to that in a second, what are the different options. So for now, we only include two operators, a cosmological constant and a Newton coupling. This is, of course, not a Laplace truncation, and one needs to go beyond that.
But if it is a fixed point, it's without the scales. It doesn't have scales.
Exactly. So it becomes scale invariant at high energies.
And the cosmological constant, then, what it is? Because it's
So the cosmological constant, you need to read off at k equals 0, because the physics is at k equals 0, where you have solved your path integral. It doesn't matter what you put at high at k to infinity. This is not physics. Physics is once you have integrated out all quantum fluctuations. And so in this simple example now, you could say, I want to have my cosmological constant 0. Then you put yourself on the Green trajectory, and then you end up here. You have a vanishing cosmological constant. But you can also say that you want to have a finite cosmological constant. Then you choose another trajectory. And here it goes to infinity, but this is the dimensionless version. So the dimension full version would go to here a finite negative value. So you can choose any cosmological constant you like. Because it's a UV relevant direction, anything is possible.
The fixed point is free, or what is that? The fixed point, how the theory look like in the fixed point?
Non-interacting. Interacting fixed point.
It's an interacting UV fixed point, yes. So the statement is that even at highest energies, gravity remains interacting, not like QCD, where at highest energies it becomes free.
But it's not known what is the nature of the theory. Is a conformal theory or what?
Well, it becomes scale invariant at highest energies. And typically scale invariance goes then hand in hand with conformal invariance, but it's only at highest energies, and there's also no proof or any further statement that the symmetry will enhance to a conformal symmetry in this case. The only thing is it's scale invariant.
This is an approximation, right?
So this is still a result from 25 years ago, lowest order truncation.
But I'm a little bit surprised that you say that only when k is equal to 0, it's physical. So now you're not in agreement with the Wilsonian approach. In the Wilsonian approach, of course, at any k, when you integrate out momentum, it exactly reproduces physics at lower scales.
Yes. Yes. So
the effective action in the Wilsonian sense is always physical. But in your case, it's only for k equal to 0.
So the effective action is... If I solve the path integral and I obtain the effective action, of course, this is a physical object. We obtain the effective action as a boundary condition of this Wetterlich equation so the quantum effective action is a boundary condition here. So, nonetheless, often people use K to assess physics because, roughly speaking, you can treat k as momenta in some cases.
So when you say that integrating out k is a Wilsonian way of doing it, it's not correct,
huh? At k, I integrate out momenta of the order of this k.
But the Wilsonian integrates out momentum from the cutoff to k. And all physics below k is identical to the physics before because it's the same action. It hasn't changed. You're just integrating out momentum of the past itself.
I'm doing exactly that. I start at highest momenta and I integrate out from highest momenta to lowest momenta.
Yeah, but in Wilsonian, if you stop at k, then physics below k is identical to the real physics of the complete past itself. I mean, that's the whole idea of the Wilsonian normalization group.
So
why is lambda k not physical?
So, Okay, so if you stop at some finite k, you can already read off some physics. That I agree. But it depends on what kind of operator you look. I mean, the cosmological constant does not change with scale. The cosmological constant does not have energy dependence. If you want to know what is the cosmological constant, you need to integrate all quantum fluctuations that contribute to vacuum energy. So the k, that there's no energy dependence of the cosmological constant. That is the main point.
I thought all coupling constants has momentum dependence.
That how would
scale dependence, but not momentum dependence. I think there's two different like momentum scales. One is k, which is an unphysical RG scale.
Yeah.
And there is a physical momentum scale.
But I thought this k was the moment. That was why this is cut off. You're integrating out.
That is my cutoff scale, not.
So this is the scale.
But it's not a physical momentum scale. It's an RG scale.
Yes. So there's no momentum dependence of the... How would you define a momentum dependence of a vacuum energy? You cannot probe the vacuum with different momenta.
Okay.
Maybe another angle to see that lambda k cannot be physical is that the way... So the exact form of lambda or shape of lambda k as a function of k strongly or will depend on the regulator function r of k. Which obviously is something that we can choose.
But I would think that when you have an effective action, you set the source is equal to zero, and you take the functional derivative with respect to the metric.
Exactly.
And,
yeah.
And then you get your universe. And the universe will have exactly the radius of 1 over the square root of lambda k. So why is this not a scale?
And maybe I just skip some slides because I want to have it. So in the end, you want to have this object, right? So this is now at k equals zero. So this is now the quantum effective action. And of course, here I have a lambda, but this I cannot assign any momentum dependence to this lambda. This is just a number. And this is the number that has been achieved after I have integrated out our quantum fluctuation. So this is not the bare lambda. This is not the fixed point lambda. This is the lambda that I get after I start at the fixed point and I integrate out all quantum fluctuations.
Okay, go on, please.
Yeah. So there's more.
Yeah, I have a related question. So can I think of this Vetterlich equation and this k as a Kalman-Simonchik and with k being mu? Is that basically...
You can think of this the regulator as Kalman-Simonchik. So yes, you can think of it similar to a Kalman-Simonchik equation, yeah.
So do I understand correctly that this object here above is the thing that you would measure in experiments? So you would like to fix the couplings in this action?
Yes, so this is in some sense the end goal of the computation. I want to know what is, I want to get lambda in G Newton such that it matches the known values, and I want to compute these functions FR, FC, and then all higher order functions that relate to curvature invariants.
But this is a result which follows from integrating out an object that you don't actually know what it is. So the microscopic action you don't know.
Exactly. So we are determining the microscopic action by looking for a fixed point. So the starting point is the fixed point. And we start from there, integrate out quantum fluctuations, and in the end, I get my object gamma, which has n. So there's things that I can choose because there's relevant directions at the UV fixed point. For example, the cosmological constant and G Newton. I can choose it at the end to be what I want because these are relevant directions at the UV fixed point. But other functions in the effective action, I cannot choose. They're predicted from the UV fixed point because they're not relevant directions.
But now the effective action, the action at the ultraviolet fixed point there, this has lambda k and g of k.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Came with k to infinity.
And lambda k is infinity and g of k is zero. So exactly what is the effective action at the ultraviolet fixed point? Because this was your starting point, you said.
Yeah, so you're talking now about at the UV fixed point,
yeah.
The dimension full Newton coupling is zero, and the dimension less the dimension full Newton lamp cosmological constant is infinity. That is absolutely correct.
Yeah.
But it's not the dimension full quantities that are relevant in.
What is the action then?
It's a most likely some kind of non-local fixed point action. But it's not not clear what it is.
You know it in your truncation, huh? Because your calculator is also about that fixed point.
Yeah, in my truncation, I know it, yeah.
So what is it?
It has the same shape as the quantum effective action, just with different kind of coefficients. And then while I integrate our fluctuations, these functions change, and in the end, I obtain a quantum effective action.
Can you write it down? Sorry, I'm just curious what it is. But please go on.
Yeah, maybe that's...
Sure, okay.
Just to make sure I understand. So you would fix the experiment, the values that are free, or the coupling that are free, you would fix by experiment. Then you would hope to be able to integrate the flow back so that you get some unique answer about the microscopic action.
So we compute the fixed point. And we compute how many relevant directions are at this fixed point. And this is related to the predictivity. So for example, I would compute the fixed point in my truncation, which has 20 operators. And I find that 3 of them are relevant. And then I integrate out from this UV fixed point to the infrared. And for each relevant direction, I need to fine-tune the trajectory such that I get the answer that of the couplings that I want. So for example, that the Newton coupling has the measured value, and for example, that the cosmological constant, I typically tune it to 0, but that is a choice because we have typically 3 relevant directions at the UV fixed point. But then other couplings, other higher order operators, are predictions. So I need to fix the number of relevant directions. That is the trajectories that I'm choosing.
But so you make an assumption, you make a truncation. Out of this truncation, you use that there is possibly a fixed point in order to go back to k equals 0. Then you measure something. So then you would integrate to actually something which is not truncated.
I mean, we always work in truncations. I think it's impossible to work in setups that are not that do not have truncations. But the principle is, yes, I choose my truncation. I compute, and I hopefully find a UV fixed point. And then I integrate to k equals 0 such that I match the experiments that I know of, G Newton, cosmological constant, and the rest is a prediction. But the physics is at k equals 0, and I do not integrate back up. So that's not necessary.
No, okay, maybe I should stop, but just last part. I would like to understand, how do you constrain the microscopic action as such? Because you always start in a truncation. So if you assume this is really a fundamental theory, what tells you what is allowed to write down in a microscopic action or not?
So I want to write down, for example, all operators that are compatible with the symmetry. So if I now do an expansion in curvature invariants, then I can sort them in mass dimension. So at lowest order, I only have the cosmological constant. Then I have the Ricci scalar, and at each order I get more and more operators. And now I need to choose which operators I include in my truncation. And typically, people obviously start at lower orders and then try to go as far as possible. And it's of course a choice. I mean, it's a well motivated choice because most of these operators are canonically irrelevant. And you would need insanely strong quantum fluctuations in order to make them relevant. And this is not happening in the cases that people have looked at it.
Because I'm also confused. But since you don't have any scaled UV fixed point, how can you decide which operators are important and which are not?
Which operator is?
Important to keep and which are not. Why don't you put them all?
So. There's a canonical dimension to this operator. So these two operators are canonically relevant. These three operators are canonically marginal, and then all higher order ones are canonically irrelevant. And now you can typically what you write down is canonical critical exponent plus the quantum one. And of course, the quantum one can, in principle, be very strong. So you never know, for example, by chance, does this operator become relevant due to quantum fluctuation. But what we have seen in computations is that I should have included a plot, but I didn't, that typically the quantum fluctuations only change the relevancy by one or at most two in the relevancy. So if I have a dimension 6 operator, I would need a quantum corrections of more than 2 to make it relevant. If I have a dimension 20 operator, I would need an insanely large quantum fluctuation. This is not happening. So cutting off is actually well motivated. Yeah. But of course, we want to improve our truncation as much as possible. And so the goal of the field is, of course, to enlarge truncations as much as possible. So I have not talked at all about what I am doing. So actually, I'm not doing expansions in curvature invariants. I'm actually doing expansions in correlation functions. So I'm saying that I'm interested in to evolve correlation functions in gravitons. So for example, this would be a flow equation for the graviton propagator. And then I have a flow equation for the graviton three-point functions. And so, and then instead of looking in curvature invariants, I'm looking in correlation functions. This has the advantage that I can actually expand my background around a flat background. Here, flat Euclidean, but depending on how this talk goes, I will also talk shortly about Lorentzian backgrounds. And then I evolve these this coupled set of correlation functions to k equals 0 and match it then back to curvature operators. But of course, this is also in the same way that the curvature expansion becomes very messy in gravity, this also becomes very messy in the correlation functions, because the basis elements of each of these endpoint function grows very, very quickly with higher order endpoint functions. Let me actually think if I skip a few slides, because otherwise.
But I mean, as a matter of principle, you couldn't even do it in any space that's not flat.
It is possible, but it's very, very tricky, because having a flat background is very advantageous, because I can just Fourier transform, and then I can solve these integrals in momentum space. But of course, I can also try to solve the loop integrals with other methods, heat kernel methods, and it's technically way more challenging, but is not impossible. So
you're probably also using Poincaré invariants in some essential way, no? In these constructions. Well, that's of course tied to the high symmetry of the Hamiltonian space.
Yes. Yeah.
But again, may I ask gamma k of g bar h? That should only be it should only be a function of g bar plus h.
No, this object is precisely a function of both, except at k equals 0. So the reason is...
So it is not a physical object.
Exactly. Only at k to 0, it is a physical object. And this is actually the main point why I expand in this kind of objects and not in curvature invariants. Because the problem is, it's in some sense, we're regularizing a path integral. And it's impossible to use a regularization which preserves the symmetry. So in some sense, one can imagine a symmetry to be a hypersurface in this space of infinitely many couplings. So now I have here my theory space. So here each operator has one coupling, and I'm just plotting here the couplings. And if I now say I want my right, a diffeomorphism symmetry, this cuts out a hypersurface in this space of infinitely many couplings. But in fact, if I now add my regulator, I'm breaking the diffeomorphism symmetry. So now, suddenly, I'm not here anymore in the space where I preserve this. I'm outside this regime where I have broken my diffeomorphism symmetry. But as I integrate out, my regulator is vanishing, and in the end, I get a theory which preserves diffeomorphism symmetry. And this is actually that's why these objects depend on G bar and H separately, and that's also one of the main reasons why I'm doing this, so I can actually disentangle the broken symmetry and restore it in the infrared.
But I thought k equal to zero was an infrared fixed point.
And I mean, there are infrared fixed points, but
exactly with k equal to zero, you have the Gaussian fixed point, and you have also other infrared fixed points. Isn't that true?
So there is a Gaussian fixed point, but at the Gaussian fixed point, g is not zero, but g is has the value that the dimension. I mean, the dimensionless g is zero, but the dimension full g has exactly the value that we measure.
Yeah, and lambda is equal to zero there. Yeah?
But I don't need to go to the Gaussian fixed point. I can also go in another area, and then I have a dimension full. I have a non-vanishing cosmological constant.
Yeah, but it's a fixed point, k equals to zero, in the flow.
Not necessarily. No, I mean, if I can do this in a standard model, and in a standard model there is no infrared fixed point, but because particles become massive, the flows it freezes out, and I can integrate to k equals zero nonetheless, although there is no fixed point because particles become massive and they decouple.
But maybe if you show the flow to me again, this randomization group flow.
Which?
You mean the truncated
one? Yeah, the truncated. Yeah. So the arrow is k flowing to zero.
Yes.
Yeah. So there's the green one is a Gaussian fixed point.
Yeah.
And the other ones, they all, if they're physical, they all end up at the other infrared fixed point with a finite lambda equal to 1/2 or whatever.
I mean, there's also trajectories that go off to infinity, so you can call infinity a fixed point.
But do you call these physical regions?
I mean,
going off to infinity then?
Yeah, because the dimension full cosmological constant stays finite. So if I plot.
You mean this is anti
but negative?
Yeah, negative. So it's anti de Sitter space.
Yeah. So you can choose, of course. I mean, but the cosmological constant, the dimension full cosmological constant in this region remains finite and negative.
Yeah, negative. Yeah. But now I was thinking about the positive ones. But they all seem to flow to. Okay. But,
I mean, if you don't want negative cosmological constant, but
let's discuss it afterwards.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would suggest, since we are already 45 minutes into the talk, to...
Well, you asked us to...
No, I'm...
No, it's fine, but maybe we can manually speak a couple of hours.
No, please not.
I will be around for dinner, so maybe we can have also the discussions later on.
Yeah, sure. No problem. So I'm thinking maybe I skip to the Lorentzian computations, just because I think that's also of interest to many people here. So still the same setup, but now I want to expand not around a flat Euclidean background, but I want to expand about a flat Minkowski background. And I guess I don't need to really motivate this. I guess the motivation is rather obvious. We live in a world with Lorentzian signature. And also, if you want to test the unitarity of the theory, we need access to a time evolution. So we need to be able to access time-like momenta, for example, for scattering amplitudes. And also, if you want to know if a propagator has Gauss or tachyons, we need Lorentzian signature. So this is the motivation why this is highly relevant. And the tool that I'm using for Lorentzian computation is the Schell and Lehmann spectral representation. So here, you see a schematic scheme of a propagator, so G of Q Q squared is my propagator related to the Shannon-Lehmann spectral representation. So this is the complex plane of the propagator. Here there is a pole, and here there's a branch cut indicated. And if I now look at the spectral function, correspondingly, there's a on-shell delta peak at the mass, and then I have an ensuing multiparticle continuum. So this is, and this is of course a this nicely relates momenta, time-like momenta, which are now here on the positive half axis, and space-like momenta on the negative half axis. So in some sense, all the computation that I now did not show you in the previous part, they all were in some sense on this negative half axis of space-like momenta. So this is, or you can interpret it, and now I want to expand this space into the complex plane and time-like momenta. And just to maybe give a little bit more of intuition how these things look, so at this, for the standard Einstein-Hilbert action, I've expanded around a flat Minkowski background. The propagator, on-shell propagator, is a simple 1 over p squared, which means that my Shannon-Lehmann spectral representation is a simple delta peak at vanishing frequencies. If I instead go to a higher derivative action, and now my propagator is what I mentioned before, a 1 over p squared minus the ghost propagator. And of course, now in my spectral representation, I have the massless on-shell delta peak of the graviton, but I also have this negative delta peak around the Planck scale, which indicates the loss of unitarity in higher derivative gravity. Yeah?
So if you think about the flow equation as coming from an integral, is your expansion around Minkowski actually something where you have actually really rotated this integral? How is it related?
So in this scenario, I do start from the Lorentzian path integral. So this is not, I have not told you yet what is my setup. I will come to that in a second. But you can also think of this as integrating to k equals 0 and afterwards Vick rotating. This is also something we have done and which is also an option. One can do better than just look at classical actions. So one can do without ever doing asymptotic safety. So for example, I can compute the one-loop effective action. And in the one-loop effective action, I have the Einstein-Hilbert term, but I also have these well-known non-local factors, Ricci scalar, logarithm of box, Ricci scalar, and correspondingly with the Weyl tensor. And if I look at what I know now from this one-loop effective action about the graviton spectral function, then I can only look at it now below the Planck scale because it's effective field theory. It's only valid up to the Planck scale. And then the graviton propagator, of course, scales as 1 over p squared. This is the dominant part, but the subleading part is now this logarithmic contribution, which comes from this R log box R. So the propagator is 1 over p squared plus logarithm p squared p to the 4. Now I can translate this to a spectral function, and this is what you see here on the right-hand side. Please ignore for now on most of the lines. But the logarithm translates into a constant part. So since now quantum effects are included, we now have an on-shell multiparticle, multigraviton continuum, which starts out as a constant up to the Planck scale. So this is the expectation that you want to have, that you have now from effective field theory. What is also shown here is that in order to compute this, now I have included one-loop quantum effects, I of course needed to include gauge fixing. So now I have here two gauge fixing parameters, alpha and beta, and the value of these coefficients, C1 and C2, in effective field theory depends on these gauge fixing parameters, alpha and beta, and depending on which kind of values you choose, you get different answers for what is the multigraviton continuum of the graviton spectral function.
But shouldn't it be independent of the gauge fixing parameters? No?
No. So this is that's actually the main point why I'm having this slide, because often the naive expectation is if I have the graviton propagator, it's a gauge independent object. But so this is the transverse traceless mode. This is not gauge. And even though this is the transverse traceless mode, this is not gauge independent because the graviton carries a gauge charge. It carries a diffeomorphism gauge charge, and only the on-shell value is gauge independent. The on-shell value is not visible on this plot. This is at a spectral value to zero where you have the on-shell delta peak, and that one is gauge independent. But the off-shell part is not. And if you now want to compute scattering amplitudes, you need to combine it with other gauge variant correlation functions, and then the on-shell scattering amplitude will, of course, be gauge independent. So this is not a direct observable. That is what I'm trying to emphasize. Okay, so this is now the object that I want to compute with functional methods. And I want to quickly say a word on how, that's okay. I just want to say one word about why we were able to do this. And in some sense, so we have different regulators available in the functional normalization group. And this, in some sense, you can imagine this as different regularization schemes on the lattice. There's different choices that you can make. And regulators break symmetries, for example. And for example, some regulators can break Lorentz invariants, which doesn't mean the theory breaks Lorentz invariants, but needs to be restored at k equals 0. And what is typically the case is that all regulators in AFRG break causality. So in terms of the Schelle-Lehmann spectral representation, this means that they create cuts and poles in the complex plane of the propagator. So the propagator at finite k, at unphysical finite k, does not have a spectral representation. And only at k equals 0, this spectral representation would be restored. And so we decided now to use a regulator which does not have this problem, so which does not break the causality. So in some sense, we choose a regularization scheme which preserves the causality of the propagator. But it comes at a price. Namely, I've written down here causality, finiteness, and Lorentz invariants, and you can only choose two out of these three. You can't have all of them. And we chose to preserve causality in Lorentz invariants, but lose finiteness. And this, in the end, led to what is now a spectral renormalization group, where we work with a Kalman-Simancic cutoff, which preserves causality and Lorentz symmetry, but does not regularize the loop integrals at hand. And then we have a general.
So it's called a cutoff, nevertheless.
It's a cutoff, yeah. You don't need to necessarily call it a cutoff. In some sense, it's just a scale-dependent mass term.
Yeah, that seems to
be. I mean, it's nothing else. And then the UV regularization needs to come in additionally. And actually, there's different ways on how so we chose actually to do the UV regularization with dimensional regularization. And then you get a modified Wetterich equation, which is the spectral renormalization group.
So this is all for Lorentzian signature now?
This, you can do this in either signature. So this is either
an analog of the causality violations in the Euclidean also.
Yes. So, in Euclidean signature, you wouldn't talk about causality.
You wouldn't call it that, okay. So
yeah.
What do you get there?
I'm not sure if I understand the question.
Well, you said I can preserve only two out of the three.
Yeah. So this is a Lorentzian statement. Yeah.
That is Lorentzian statement.
But the equation that is here, you can use it Euclidean and Lorentzian. But the thought process that led us to it is Lorentzian. Okay. So where does the Schelle-Lehmann representation come in? So now we want to actually write down a flow equation directly for the Schelle-Lehmann spectral representation, which is an inherently Lorentzian object. So we start basically with a flow. So we want to set up a flow equation for the graviton spectral function. the graviton spectral function has an on-shell delta peak, which is basic, which is here at a given mass, which is tightly related to the cutoff scale. So the cutoff is a scale-dependent mass, which goes to k equals zero, which goes to zero at for k to zero. So basically, we are implementing a vanishing cosmological constant here. So at finite k, the graviton is massive. At k equals zero, the graviton is massless, as one would expect. And that is the physics. So at k equals zero, we have the physics of a massless on-shell graviton. So we have, so the parameterization is you have an on-shell delta peak and then a multi-graviton continuum. And then in each of the diagrams that I also showed you before, we now replace the propagator with the Shell-Lehmann representation. And in this way, we obtain a differential equation for the Shell and Lehmann spectral representation, which we can solve. And the goal is to integrate out the fluctuation until k equals zero. You find trajectories for the Newton coupling and for the cosmological constant. They look very similar to the Euclidean analog. I'm not going to say more about this now. And in the end, you can find the solution for the graviton spectral function. So, and this is what I show you here. So this graviton spectral function has an on-shell delta peak. It has then it starts out flat in agreement with effective field theory. It has a peak structure around the Planck scale, and then it decays off with a power law, which is related to the behavior around the asymptotically safe fixed point. So this is, in some sense, exactly what we expected. So we have classical gravity, on-shell delta peak, effective field theory below the Planck scale, and then we have a transition period to an asymptotically safe behavior. And the things that I want to emphasize is that here there is no ghosts or tachyons. A ghost state would be a negative delta peak. There is no negative delta peak in this a spectral function. If I would now Taylor expand this propagator, I would find a ghost state. But in the full expression, it's not there. So if ghost states are typically truncation artifacts of looking at finite dimensional, finitely many curvature operators. So there's no indication for unitarity violation from this spectral function. And as a very last, I still have 1 minute, we are currently trying to use this spectral function to get a handle on scattering amplitude. So this is a very, in some sense, low order truncation of the scattering amplitude, where we basically just use the computed spectral function for the graviton propagator. And now we can, for example, look at electron positron to muon antimuon scattering. And we have here the graviton part, which is increasing as one would expect from general relativity. And then there's this transition period around the Planck scale, which again has this a peak-like structure around the Planck scale. And then beyond the Planck scale, it decays. While the photon part here, for example, decays already beforehand, and then with the inclusion of gravity, it actually decays even stronger and faster. So this is a first shot at scattering amplitudes in asymptotically safe gravity. And again, here we have no indications for unitarity violations in the sense that this is compatible with all unitarity bounds from scattering amplitudes. With this, let me come to my summary. I actually didn't talk about all of these things today, but I hope I could give you a slight overview of what this has been done in asymptotically safe gravity, including the recent results in Lorentzian signature. And I hope I could show you that this is a small key step towards scattering and unitarity. And thank you for your attention.
Thank you. taking one with a nice talk and for your willingness to answer a lot of questions. So we still have some time for questions.
At the end, you can think, even if you have gravity, you can think this theory as a theory in Minkowski space, that in the low energy you are looking like gravity, but something like that is possible.
So we are expanding around Minkowski space, but it's not that Minkowski space is the physical, it's not a physical background, it's just a technical choice of background. It doesn't mean that the true world has as a ground state Minkowski space. That is not what I'm saying.
If it wasn't, there weren't, I mean, graviton doesn't have the meaning I usually give it, right? If my background was not Minkowski, I don't even know what gravitons are. So this is just an...
You can have a curved background, that's what I mean. Still Lorentzian signature, but curved.
Yeah, that's what I mean too, exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
But you don't, of course, have gravitons, you know, in the sense of...
Yes, exactly. So that's what...
The representations of the Poincaré group, but you don't even have that on the de Sitter background.
Yes. I mean, we are making use of that, that we can now define standard quantum field theory tools around this expansion point. But it still doesn't give the physical meaning to the expansion point.
So can I ask something else? So you have various ways of doing the expansion, and you are now doing it in these graviton...
correlation functions, yeah?
Correlation functions. Can I say anything about convergence? I mean, of course, I don't even have a small parameter here, or am I mistaken?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. So. I don't have this on my slides, unfortunately, but I mean, we do want to find convergence in all kinds of expansions.
Of course, we wish. Yeah.
So
can you say anything about it?
Yes. So the in a expansion in correlation functions, the highest order that has been computed was the graviton four-point functional. We did this actually in 2016. And what we did see is that we saw some first signs of apparent convergence in the sense that the stability of the system increased by including that next to order. So the lowest order critical exponents did not change significantly with the next order. And we saw an increased stability of the system after adding the next two leading order. Stability in the sense of we have, of course, fiducial parameter, such as gauge fixing parameters, etc., and regulator parameters. So you expect that when you vary them, that the system remains stable. And of course, this is... And what you want to see is that the higher you go in the computations, the more stable it becomes with the varying of these fiducial parameters. So we see signs of apparent convergence in this expansion. And what other people have done is they typically cut out slices in this curvature expansion. So for example, computing up to r to the power of 100 and something. And also there you see excellent convergence. I don't have it on my slides. I'm sorry for that.
The second version of my question before is that, forget about Minkowski space, but there is a notion of localized observables, because people say that in quantum gravity you have like observables that are gauge invariant that are attached to some region of the space. Some people say that. And in your theory, somehow you have that idea that you have operators really attached to some region, or is something non-local that you don't know?
So the correlation functions that I'm computing, they're not observables. So these are gate. Those are not directly observables. But of course, as soon as I look, for example, at a relational observable, I can make them an observable quantity. Or of course, if I now look at a scattering amplitude, this is also an observable quantity.
Suppose that your ultraviolet theory were like a normal ultraviolet conformal field theory, then I could say, well, this is the real space-time, the one that I can attach degrees of freedom. Then I, at infrared, I don't know what I see, is completely messy. But here, your ultraviolet still is not local somehow, or you don't know, perhaps.
Yeah, most likely the fixed point is some kind of non-local object, but it's not entirely clear what it is. That is still open to research.
But that's the most interesting question. The most interesting question is, what is the geometry at the ultraviolet? Yeah. That's what we want to know. What's happened at the Big Bang? At the real.
But that's not the that's not. I would say that's not the fixed point. For that, we want to go to k equals zero. And then send, and send other objects to infinity. So we are then.
But then I have to ask, what the hell is K?
K is a technical tool.
But why is K equal to infinity then related to anything?
It just gives you a boundary condition that allows you to solve the Puff integral, nothing else.
Solve the Puff integral.
For example, the comparison in holography, you will have an ultraviolet, somehow you will have a normal quantum field theory in the boundary, and where space-time is well-defined. And then in the bulk, as you go away from the ultraviolet, you get something that doesn't have a localization. Perhaps you can have here the same, in the sense that the ultraviolet theory could be normal, in the sense there is a space-time there, fixed one. But it's not what you're thinking about.
No, it's at least not what we are expecting, yeah.
Well, it just seems to me that if you just think naively about this, you take your the simplest truncated gamma k, then your usual prescription is that the extremum of this is space-time. Mm-hmm. That's what Einstein's equation tells us. So we have a G and we have a lambda depending on K. And we get then a de Sitter universe which depends on K. And we know exactly how this de Sitter universe behaves as a function of K. In fact, we know that lambda K goes to infinity and G of K goes to zero. So it shrinks. Nevertheless, for any value of K, and I can tell you this because I've done the calculation, for any value of K, you can still study perfectly well Gaussian fluctuations around this de Sitter space. So there is, if I follow the manual of Martin and Anata and so on, then we calculate our effective action as a function of k. Then we kill the tadpole terms by saying that the derivative of gamma with respect to the metric is supposed to be equal to zero. And then, of course, we get the de Sitter space out. It's a function of k. I don't care what this k is, but I know g of k and I know lambda of k.
Mm-hmm.
So I know what this universe around these fluctuations should have. This is a de Sitter universe which has a radius 1 over square root of lambda k. And since lambda k goes as k, this radius goes to 0.
Mm-hmm.
So the universe just shrinks to a point. This is the prediction for this simplest truncation, I would say. I'm just following the manual of standard effective actions. Why is it wrong? I don't understand that.
Well, I think I would not agree to the statement because it gives K an interpretation.
No, only G of K and lambda of K.
Exactly. I don't see any interpretation of that. I'm only interested in lambda at K equals zero and G at K equals zero.
But you have an effective action here as a function of the fields. G.
Yeah, but my effective action doesn't know about K. There's.
No, but your effective knows about K, of course.
My average effective action knows, my scale-dependent effective action knows about K. But the effective action is only at k equals zero. That is a very definition of the Wetterich equation. So only at k equals zero, I have my scale dependent, my a full quantum effective action when I have integrated out all my quantum fluctuations.
But then it's not a, But then it's not a Wilsonian picture, huh? Because Wilsonian always starts at the oscillator with some action. It might be a lattice action. It might not be a continuum action, or so on. And then it integrates out something to get to a long momentum scale. But here you say that, that this interpretation,
I mean,
what goes on with lambda k.
It is Wilsonian-like integrating out of momentum modes. It's not exactly the Wilsonian picture.
Okay. It seems to be anti-Wilsonian, in a way.
Yeah, this seems like a discussion that can be continued.
Sure.
Maybe we take this opportunity to thank Manuel again for...